And now it is recording. So it is May 4th, 2011. This is Pat Kalshina, and I am interviewing Alex Olson, A-L-I-X-O-L-S-O-N, who is 63, born in 1947, and Martha, M-A-R-T-H-A, D, Pop, P-O-P-P, who is 65, born in 1946. So Alex and Alex and Martha are going to be interviewed together today. Why don't you each begin by telling me when you got to Madison? How, you know, this history is a history of your time in Madison. And so the first question would be, what brought you here? When did you come? Martha, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's see. If I can remember back that far. I moved here from Philadelphia, and I actually moved to Lake Mills. I was married to a man at the time, and we had one child, Timothy, who is now 36. Is that right, honey? He's 36, right?
He's 37. He's gonna be 38.
Yeah, he was born in 73. So I came to this area, and I actually came here because my ex-husband had a job here in Lake Mills, and I was madly in love with Alex at the time. But things were extremely complicated, and as they always seem to be. And so I had made a decision that I would move out here and try to stick with my marriage. And raise this wonderful child. But I was still extremely in love with this woman, as I am today. So that was, and then of course we were near Madison. And so I thought, well, you know, Madison is going to give me some opportunities to explore who I am and find a lesbian population and hopefully go back to school and just try to become a more independent person and figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And I was, of course, very focused on raising Timothy. That was the important thing. And trying to make a good life for him. So that's how I ended up in this area and eventually moved to Madison.
Okay, okay. Alex, what about you?
Well, when Martha, I was living in Philadelphia too, and when Martha left Philadelphia in 1976, then the next summer, early in 77, like in April or May, or maybe it was June, I was working in Philly, but I took a leave of absence in the summer of 77 to come out to Madison for the summer to, it was a time when she and I were going to see if we were going to stay together or not, because she was living out here and I was still back in Philly. And for your next interview, we can talk about the chaos not the chaos, but just back in the 70s, how relationships were very different than they are now.
Hmm.
Especially when there were more than two people involved. So, but anyhow, I came out here And I think I got here in June sometime, and we ended up renting a little, subletting a little apartment over on East Gorham Street for 3 months for that summer.
You and Martha.
Martha mm-hmm. and me. And
and your son?
No.
No.
He was there part of the time.
He came there, but he didn't live there the whole
yeah.
time. He came to visit. She was still living in Lake Mills also, but she sort of moved into Madison for part of the week, and, you know, it was one of those things. And
I call it the crying summer.
Yeah, a lot of tears shed, a lot of what are we doing, what's happening.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I'd ever been in Madison. That was in 77, like I said. Oh, no, that's not right. Wait. I came here in 1980. That's right, because I had been working in Philly, and I had a really good job in Philly, actually, but I came here in the summer of 80. And
that's right, because in 70s...
Never left.
And came without a job.
I took a leave of absence from my job in Philadelphia, wondering, I kept it open because I didn't know if I was going to stay here or go back.
Mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. we had to figure out what we were doing. And at the end of, towards the end of the time that I was going to stay here, we decided that we were going to stay together. We could stay together somehow. We wanted to stay together because we were very much in love with each other. And so I called back to my boss in Philly, who actually wasn't a boss at all, and I told, there were three people, three paid staff where I was working, and I was one of them. So I called the other two paid staff, and I said, sorry, but I'm not coming back. And they said, well, you know, we kind of figured you wouldn't be coming back. and so I stayed on here.
Wow.
And then I had, you know, got some jobs here, and eventually wound up working for the police department.
Okay. And I'd like you to talk about that too, but we'll wait a little bit. We'll try to be chronological here a bit. All right, so when did you make the decision? How many years have you been together? Let's preface all of this with the number of years you've been together now, so that whoever's hearing this will have that from the get-go.
It's always up for grabs.
Yeah. Do we date it back to the first bicentennial?
We met 76. Each other in 1974 in Hanover, New Hampshire. We were friends. We both worked at the same women's center there.
And it was one of those wonderful women's centers of the 70s,
yes.
where you have support groups mm-hmm. and you take assertiveness training and you sit around going, I want my meat. I want my meat.
I want my meat.
And help women do resumes and counseling and mm-hmm. laugh a lot. And
mm-hmm. oh.
women were in total, they were all discovering who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, Gloria Steinem was our leader. And
mm-hmm. of your group?
No.
No,
she was our...
She was our mentor.
Oh, she was our role model kind of.
Yes,
huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, all of Bella Abs, like all those
yes.
strong
yeah.
women of the 70s,
yeah.
you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Angela Davis, everybody was mm-hmm. just like, wow, you know,
yeah.
we can be like them.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's where we met, and we became good friends. And actually, I was on the hiring committee that hired Martha to be the executive director of the center.
Sounds impressive.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sweetheart.
And then during that time, in late 75, early 76, I guess is when things started to happen between us. And Martha actually came to me one day. Well, what happened was another woman was interested in having a relationship with me. And she wrote me a letter, and she said that she wanted to do this. And I didn't want it. I was not ready for a relationship at that point because of other things that had already happened. So I took this letter, and I went to my best friend, and I read her the letter, or showed her the letter, and I said, what am I going to do? I don't want to respond to this. I don't want to have any part of this.
And the earth moved. Because I can still remember she was standing there at the window. She was reading this letter from a woman who we both knew who had come to the Women's Center and, in fact, had lived with us, with myself and my ex-husband for a couple of days or a week or something. And she was reading this letter, and I was sitting at the desk trying to look like an executive. And I just was listening to her read it, and it was just like something happened. I thought, my God, she's a wonderful friend, but I am in love with this woman. And I didn't say anything at the time. Mm-hmm. I probably just had like my hair standing on end. And
I can still remember exactly how you looked.
Wow.
So it got more complicated after that, because I actually did end up getting into a relationship with that woman anyhow. And after that relationship had started, Martha was planning, and her ex-husband were planning on moving, and so she came to me one day and said, I need to talk to you. And we went to lunch, and I noticed that she couldn't eat a bite. And so I thought something was really wrong, and I didn't know what it was. So I said, well, let's go somewhere else, and you know, we can just talk in a more private place. And so we went up to the top of Hopkins Center, which is sort of like the Union here, where there's a big lounge and lots of chairs and lots of light and everything. And we sat down
looking there, over the campus.
Dartmouth College campus. And we sat down there, and Martha said to, she told me then, she said, I'm in love with you. And my immediate reaction before I uttered a sound was, damn it, I'm with the wrong woman. Because I was also, I mean, there had been some minor physical attraction and touching up until that point. And when she told me that, it was just sort of like my light bulb finally went off. And I think all I did was grunt, according to the stories that she tells me. I just was sort of like, oh, okay, you know. But really inside I was just erupting with, uh-huh, oh my God, you know, yes, I know I'm in love with you too. And then, of course, the second thought was, okay, what do I do about this other relationship that I'm in now?
But I just remember her saying, oh no. Uh-huh. I'm in love with you. Oh no.
But that's why I said it, because I realized, mm-hmm, oh no, yeah, I've made the wrong decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I had been urged by my women's support group, or someone in the women's support group that we had, that I should tell her. Wasn't that how it went?
Before you, yeah, left town.
Yeah, yeah. They were saying, oh, you've got to tell her. You've got to tell her. And I was like, no, I can't. I can't tell her. What good is it going to do? You know, she's going to California with this other woman. I'm moving to Philadelphia. So that was the beginning of the
world. So that was, yeah, that was in probably April of 76, and then Martha and her ex-husband did in fact move down to the Philadelphia area, and I stayed up in New Hampshire, Vermont area. And I did go to California with the other woman, as had previously been planned, but I only spent about 3 months there. And I told her when I got there that I wasn't staying, but I didn't tell her why. Mm-hmm. And then there came a time after the 3 months were up, and I just said, look, I have to go back. And I still didn't tell her why. And she was, you know, God bless her, she was fine. You know, she said, go, do what you gotta do, you know. But she didn't have any idea why. Mm-hmm. Much mm-hmm. later, I called her and disclosed why, and then, of course, she was very upset. But we, you know, that was, I couldn't do it any other way, really, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So I went back and showed up at Martha's house outside of Philadelphia. She didn't know I was coming back, and it was around Thanksgiving time. Mm-hmm. And I waited in the house. I think her ex-husband was there. Maybe he even picked me up from the airport, because at that time in our relationship, we were all friends. We all mm-hmm. knew each other. And then she came home from wherever she was and walked in, and I was sitting at the kitchen table or the dining room table, and I just remember you kind of fell down on the floor. lunch, you know, on the floor.
I never thought she'd come back. I figured she was going to have her life on the West Coast and with this other woman, and certainly the climate there is much nicer.
Right.
Philadelphia. Yeah, yeah, that was...
But it really was true love, you know, mm-hmm. and before I had left for California, we had, what's the phrase, consummated the relationship or whatever you want to, however you want to term it, and so I knew then more than ever before that this was the person, that Martha was the person for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that really gave me the impetus after the 3 months in California to say, I have to leave and come back to the person who I really felt like I was deeply in love with.
What a beautiful story.
Yeah.
And so how many years does that make for you? Do you count from consummation or moving in together? You know, that's always the trick.
We always made up didn't we make up that August 22nd anniversary? Mm-hmm. Because that was about the time that we first jumped into the sack together, you know?
Hmm.
Of 1976, so I guess you could say it was from then. I don't know, but then mm-hmm. there's different times because we didn't ever live together until we were in Madison. And
that makes 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. I had to do the math here on paper. Well, so at some point you moved in together in Madison with your son that became both of your son. Son?
That didn't happen quite like that. But.
No? All right. So take me to Madison when you move in together then. Or when you begin your life together in Madison.
Yeah. Well, we had the sublet, the summer of the crying.
Yeah, 1980.
And it was really an interesting time because the adults involved, so that was the two of us and my ex-husband, we were all, at that point, trying to raise Timothy together and have more of a relationship that everyone was nurturing him. And I think it was very good for Tim. But I felt very worn out from it and distracted and
mm-hmm.
confused, and I needed some support and guidance, that's for sure. So we didn't actually all live together, but we spent a lot of time together. And then at some point we decided we would go ahead and buy a house together.
Yeah, let's see. When I first came here, I lived on couches, but then I moved to, there was a lesbian collective on Spade Street called Grace Harbor that was, Mary Bennett, Nancy Dungan, Sherry Maples.
Oh.
Then she moved out, I moved in, and then Shelley Gaylord lived there for a while. And that was the center of a lot of fabulous comings and goings and people and parties, and just it was a good way to meet people,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm. And it was political as well.
And it was very political, as you can imagine, with that group of people.
Mm-hmm. There were things going on with the Willie Street Co-op at that time, and they were changing their whole philosophy of being a collective.
Yeah, and you started working at the co-op.
Well, that was when I got pregnant with Emily.
Oh, so that was a little bit...
Yeah.
She was working at the co-op. I was working at... I was a bartender at La Sestrada, and I was also teaching weightlifting at the Y. WCA on the square. They had a weight room for women called Body Works. And I worked there, and I volunteered at the co-op, but Martha actually was a paid staff member at the co-op.
Yeah, so that was 30 years ago, because I was pregnant with Emily, and she's turning 30 on Mother's Day.
Okay, so you were pregnant with Emily. There is so much here. This is probably going to take more than one. You were pregnant with Emily.
Yeah, she was still living.
That was your husband's sperm?
Yes.
Okay, just checking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. Yes, both the children have the same father.
Uh-huh.
And he's a huge part of their lives.
Nice.
Yeah. It is. It's good for them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it wasn't until we didn't buy our first house until 82. So in 80 I was living in Grace Harbor, and then Emily was born in May of 81. And then that summer, at the end of August, I started at the police academy. So August of 81.
Okay.
And it wasn't until a year after that that we moved in together. So that first year between 81 and 82, I was living in an apartment on Spade Street, just like an efficiency apartment, and Martha was still living in Lake Mills.
So when, Martha, did you leave your husband officially, or was this just... was there some point at which you formally were with Alex and no longer with your husband? Or was it just kind of a threesome for a while? I don't really mean a threesome, but you were kind of married, with Alex too. And
well, let's see. What was the question again?
At what point does Alex become your primary relationship? I guess that would be the question. I mean, I know that in your heart, mm-hmm. Alex was your primary relationship. That's very clear.
Yes, she was.
But when did you terminate your marriage officially? I guess that
would be... We didn't formally get divorced till 84.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was more like about 89 or 90, so somewhere in there. It took a long time. 88, 89, somewhere in there.
So that was after you were living together in your house, but you didn't formally get divorced. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we bought a house together on Jennifer Street in 1982 when we lived there for 6 years.
Okay.
And then we moved over to the Near West Side.
Okay.
And lived there for, 16 years?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 16
All the kids
years.
Were in high school.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. After school.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well.
But definitely when I was pregnant with Emily, it felt like we were a pretty solid couple, mm-hmm. and we did everything together, and I think that was.
And how was
I know that
husband?
Emily thinks of Alex totally as her mom.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And was your husband accepting of this at the time?
He was accepting up to a point.
Uh-huh.
I think, I shouldn't speak for him, but I think his idea was that he wanted to have the American dream,
mm-hmm.
Because mm-hmm. he is a gay man, and he wanted to have the home, the family, and do it on his terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I first told him that I was in love with Alex, he seemed to think it was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like, well, oh, that's interesting. You know, I said, I'm in love with a woman. I told him that when we were living in Philadelphia. And that was 76. And I was so miserable just trying to figure out why I wasn't just able to follow my heart and mm-hmm. to be with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think then too, it was really a different political atmosphere.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I wanted so much to just have a home and mm-hmm. have the children and be with the woman who I finally met in my life, who was the love of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was always saying to my daughter, Emily, why are you wasting so much time worrying about guys? Because, you know, I did that, and then when I was 30, I fell in love with a woman. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, life is just so interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah, yeah. So you're in Madison. What kinds of things did you initially do? So you're bartending at Les Estrada, Alex.
Timothy used to refer to it as Les Estrada.
Yeah.
I had to agree.
Yeah.
So what was that like for you? Tell us about there aren't a lot of people that we've interviewed at this point who have close relations with Les Estrada, and you certainly did as a bartender. What was it like in those days?
It was wild. It was. I loved working there. That's how I met so many people because I first moved here, and I got the job that summer that I first moved here. I think I met Penny Malio. And ended up playing ball for her. She was my coach for many years. I played in the Alabama League. And she was also the bar manager at Les Estrada at the time. And so, I worked with Deanna and Terry. Those are the other two women who were bartending with me. I can't remember either of their last names now, and I haven't seen them for probably 28 years. But.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I met people like Donna Winter for the first time, and Carla Trujillo, who mm-hmm. used to work here at the university, who was a bodybuilder. We met her there. We met the whole community there, basically, because it wasn't just a bar. It was also, you probably remember it, it was also like a lunchroom. Oh, you don't remember it at all?
I came the year after it burned.
Oh, it was great. It was like this meeting place, community space, women's bar.
Good food.
And like a dining and lunchroom, mm-hmm. you know. It left a huge void when it burned down. And I worked there 80 to 81, so it was at the top of the disco craze. It was all about dancing, and it was still when you could smoke in bars. I remember that because I had just finally quit cigarettes, and then I had to, you know, work in a bar where everybody smoked. And there was drama and trauma and, you know, the usual stuff that's associated with bars and
pool,
drunken frat boys stumbling in and, you know, trying to make a scene and getting booted out unceremoniously by some dykes booting their ass, you know. I mean, and there was a pool table there, and, you know, people were snorting lines of coke in the bathroom, and, you know, it was just like the whole gamut, the whole spectrum of lesbianism was in there, you know, from one end to the other.
And there were certain days or nights, I can't remember, where you dress up. Remember Mary Bennett bunch of us dressed up to be waitresses mm-hmm. one night in some kind of vintage costumes mm-hmm. and there were so many activities from there. It really mm-hmm. was the hub.
It was great. Yeah. Some nights I'd cocktail waitress out at the tables when they had like the fancy dress up stuff like mm-hmm. you're talking about. Other times it was just straight bartending. Ed Durkin, who was then the chief of the fire chief, he'd come in all the time with Gene Parks. I'd always serve Gene gin because that was his drink. I mean, it was just like this incredible place where people came. It's just like when you first come to town, everybody goes to a room, you know, mm-hmm, sort of like to mm-hmm. get hooked up. Well, people came to Les Estrada for the same reason.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the place to go. That was.
Mm-hmm. What about Butch Femme at Les Estrada? Did it exist at all?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It sure did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that going on there. Yeah, a whole lot.
But there was also an element of suspicion or a little bit disapproval of feminine women.
Mm-hmm.
There was a real strong, I'm thinking about like 80, 81, when the separatists were really pretty vocal and don't speak to men.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
If you're a femme, then you're not really a lesbian.
You're a sham.
Yeah.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
They have boots and a flannel shirt. And
right.
Preferably grease stained. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there was There's a lot of that, I'd
say. Yeah, because I remember when I finally had to break down and tell the people at Willie Street Co-op that I was pregnant. I remember the comment from Patty Dudley, who said, "With a man?" And I was like, "Yes. I'm sorry, it wasn't a turkey baster."
Well, did you tell them it was a gay man? Help.
Yeah. I think that would have gone right over their heads.
Yeah. Possibly.
So, what do you think about the fire? Do you have any thoughts about what happened?
I've heard all kinds of rumors and stories. I wasn't there when it happened. I wasn't working there anymore. And I really, it would be pure speculation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm.
What a heartbreak.
It was a heartbreaker. Yeah. I'll say that. Yeah. Ugh. But other than that, why it happened or what caused it, I really don't know. And mm-hmm. I don't think I want to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. I'm sorry.
I remember Jean Barlow, she came on and managed while I was there for a while, too. Because Penny left, but Penny was just the bar manager. I don't remember who the regular manager was when I started working, but I know Jean came on, Penny left, and then Jean came on.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jean left and went to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
By then I was gone. Because I probably stopped working there. I worked there about a year. I probably worked there from like June to June, mm-hmm. 81.
Mm-hmm.
You did, because the night I went into labor with Emily,
we were just closing the bar.
Yeah, it was 2 a.m.
It was after. It was like 2:30 mm-hmm. or something like that. Yeah.
So that would have been May 8th.
Yeah, I probably
1981.
I probably didn't work too much past that. I would maybe another month. That was about it, probably.
How did you make the decision to get involved with the police department?
Well, I had always wanted to be a detective ever since I was little, and I had actually gone down to the central station in Philly and gotten an application when I was living there, but it was extremely racist. Frank Rizzo was both the mayor and the police commissioner, mm-hmm. and his officers were shooting, you know, African Americans for running stop signs, and I just was like, I'm not doing this here, you know, I can't. And so then I came here and was just looking for a job in the paper one day, and they had an ad in there. Huh. So it just sort of like was like one of those aha moments, you know. Madison seems like a cool town. I'd heard a little bit about Chief Cooper, and they were hiring, so I just said, okay, fine, I'll go down and get an application. So it just was sort of serendipity, really, I think, that I was here at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to hire women. There weren't too many women on the department when I started. I think the first class of women, the first woman had been hired in 77. And when I got hired in 81, there were probably less than a dozen women on the department.
Okay, okay.
So it was a good time.
What was it like? I've interviewed a number of firefighters, and they talk about the struggles they had.
Yeah.
Was it a struggle in the police department,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, it was, especially for I was an out lesbian mm-hmm. when I got hired, and it was still a pretty much of an old boys network. Mm-hmm. There was an A team and a B team. Cooper had just been hired in 80. And the A team were the Vietnam vets and the old crowd from the former chief. I can't remember his name now. And then the B team were the ones who saw Cooper as a breath of fresh air and a new vision, and they were much younger, and they wanted to follow him. And so there was this real tension on the department between the old timers and the newcomers. And of course, a lot of the newcomers, or some of the newcomers, were female. And some of them were African American, which had never been mm-hmm. done, you know, happened before. And some of them were lesbian, which had never, you know, Donna Winter was the first out lesbian that they hired, as far as I know.
Hmm.
And she was the class right before me. So, yeah, it was really different. I mean, Madison was different then. If you had a gun call once a month, it was a big deal.
Hmm.
By the time I retired, we had 5-6 gun calls a night. every night, you know. So it really, the city got really big. It got much more fractured and spread out. People got a lot more callous and inured to violence,
mm-hmm.
in a way that when I first started, people really weren't. When I first started, the big deal was drunk driving, bar fights, burglaries, you know, bad boys running around in the middle of the night, that kind of stuff. It wasn't all this home invasion, mm-hmm. crack hadn't hit Madison yet. The gangs were here, but they weren't doing anything. It was much tamer, I guess is what I'm, you know, there was lots more stuff going on at Main and King with the prostitution.
Yeah.
That eventually got driven out into the south side and the hotels, you know, the crack hotels along mm-hmm. the Beltline.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, really different. The cars were different, the uniforms were different, the weapons we had were different, everything was different.
How many years did you spend on the police force?
29 years and 4 months.
And you retired just recently.
Mm-hmm. January 7th.
How did you deal with any discrimination, or do you think it made it easier that you were an out lesbian than if you had tried to work the force in the closet?
Yeah, I think it was a lot easier, but it was also harder.
Yeah.
Because then you got a target on your back, you know.
Yeah.
But what people told me, I had a couple of run-ins with people that got handled informally, basically. One of them kind of developed into something a little bit bigger than that. But basically people said, we don't really care what you do in your private life, but you need to prove to us that you can be a good cop on the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you showed that you could hold your own, or you could solve a problem, or you weren't afraid in terms of getting, you know, down and dirty with somebody, and you could handle yourself well, then other officers respected you and would accept you. That was the standard, really,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you developed a reputation of just taking the easy calls or ducking the hard calls in your shift, or not responding to calls in your beat that you were responsible for, so someone else would have to take them for you, or screwing up a call somehow, or just not knowing what to do after a certain point when you're supposed to know how to do it, those people didn't last too long.
Uh-huh.
Because the other officers didn't want to deal with them.
Sure.
Know, because they couldn't count on them.
Mm-hmm.
That was the standard, really. Now, there was a subculture of homophobia in the department, too, when I started, that was pretty strong. Not as strong as it was in the fire department, but it was still pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some run-ins with people who didn't like lesbian cops, other officers,
mm-hmm.
who made no bones about it and thumped their Bibles and wore little pins underneath the flaps on their shirt that said straight edge or something. I don't know. I can't remember what it said.
Mm-hmm.
And made a big deal of it. Somebody complained about me, made a false complaint about me, about some behavior that I was alleged to have done in the locker room, which was completely false. And that sort of went up the chain a little bit and then died.
And wasn't there something that happened with, like, some of the officers wearing a cross?
Yeah, they had a cross or something. They had, like, this sort of covert group of officers who were homophobic and
Christian.
They knew they couldn't just wear something on their uniform, because you can't wear anything on your uniform except what's, you know,
mm-hmm.
Supposed to be worn. So, but the pockets have these flaps that lift up
mm-hmm.
on the shirts, and so they pin the pin on the underside of the flap, and then they'd go around, you know, like flapping each other to make sure that, you mm-hmm. know, we're all together here. You know, it was ludicrous, and we finally had a big meeting. Sort of a showdown, the them versus us kind of thing. And one guy showed up with a Bible, and Donna Winter just lit into him and said, put that thing away. You didn't come here. This isn't church. We're here to talk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was great. And mm-hmm. and then the chief got involved. Chief Cooper got involved and basically banned the wearing of these mm-hmm. pins or buttons or whatever they were. I can't even remember anymore.
So was he a good ally?
Yeah, he was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was. I really liked him. I respected him a lot as a leader. he had a vision that, that no one since has had for that department.
Yes.
And he really acted on it and really saw it through. And definitely pushed us into the 20th century in terms of policing, not just technology-wise, but just in terms of the whole community-oriented policing approach and the problem-solving. And there's just much more to being a cop than writing tickets and, you know, throwing your weight around. And he really had an incredible vision and made the department one of the top departments in the country. You know, by the time he left, it was in a very good place. So, yeah, I'm very proud to have been a part of it, and yeah, it was quite a ride.
Yeah, I bet it was. Did you ever worry about her, Martha?
Yes, of course. I've worried about her for years. I'm still worried about her. Yeah, I did worry about her, although I felt confident that she was able to handle herself. She was always in really, really top condition, very athletic and super bright, understood what was going on, and was very dedicated. I trusted that she wasn't going to do something stupid or fly off on an ego trip. Most of the time. And I think the hardest part of the job was that she really wasn't around a whole lot because it was very demanding. And it just absorbed her whole being into into the career, into the job. And it was something she always wanted to do. I mean, that was her love. She wanted to be a detective. And so she was fulfilling her dream from childhood. So she's really, really gotten a great opportunity to do that.
I just want to say that I would not have had the same success and the same positive career without Martha's support and love. It would have been impossible.
Wow. And you, Martha, tell me about your work.
Well, I was a speech pathologist when I graduated from college in 68. But I really wasn't that fond of the career. It was just something I had gotten into. And so I always wanted to do something a little different. But when I got out of college, I traveled, I worked, and then I married at when I was 24, which seems alarmingly young now. So I felt like I didn't have a lot of time to look around and think about what I wanted to do. And then when I went from the East Coast back to here, to the Midwest, I decided, well, that would be my opportunity to go back to the university to explore a different career. And plus, when we lived in Philadelphia, I went to the University of Delaware and started studying nutrition, because that was another thing that I was interested in. And so I did that for a while when we lived in Philadelphia. And then when we were here, when I first moved out here, and I was living in Lake Mills, I decided to go to the university in Madison. And I was taking some courses in theater, and I was interested in getting a degree in communication arts. And it was interesting. It was expensive. It was a lot of money. And I think I was working at the co-op too. And it was a lot of sacrifice for everybody. Raising the kids, we had two kids by then, and I was thinking, well, I'll get a degree in comm arts. Hopefully I can get a job doing something. Mm-hmm. But what happened was when I realized I really need to have a job with benefits and a full-time job, I went back into speech pathology, and that's how I ended up in Middleton at the high school. I was substitute teaching in Wanakee one day, and I heard somebody talking that there was going to be an opening at Middleton. And I remember I told the kids to put their heads down or stare at the blackboard or something. It was like an elementary school in Wanakee, and I ran down to a phone that was in the hall, and that must have been in like 88. And I called Middleton, and they said I could come in for an interview. So scraped together my rusty and wrinkled credentials, because the only thing I'd really done in Madison was I'd worked for the co-op for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And that was really interesting. I had had a lot of fun there. Things had been insane at the co-op. And those were in the days when you did everything. Mm-hmm. You'd cashier, you'd count up the food stamps and the money at the end of the night. Mm-hmm. You'd restock the bins. You'd take the money home in your pants.
Oh, it must have been wonderful.
It was.
That was crazy.
And stored in the oven until you could get to the bank the next day. And I met some fabulous people through the co-op, and but I knew that I needed to do something more substantial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you were hired at Middleton High School, mm-hmm. and spent your career yep. there.
Well, I spent, I guess, till I was 60.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
So I was older coming into the. Going back into the profession, and it was pretty difficult just catching up with what had happened professionally.
And did you work as a speech pathologist?
I did.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I was able to bluff my way through the interview and took the job. I think it was a pretty amazing time because a lot of things were happening in the lesbian community as well.
And that's where we should go next, because your connection with GLSEN
right.
and the gay and lesbian kids mm-hmm. at the school, talk about that a little
yeah.
bit. And you jump in, Alex, because I know that you were involved as well.
Yeah, Alex was always involved in my career moves. When I worked at the co-op, she was there as a volunteer and... I think probably served on a committee and used to come over and help me at the end of the night. We had a Dalmatian, Petunia, and she'd walk over or come over in the evening when I had to close, and mm-hmm. I'd be there all alone. And I can still remember Petunia walking up and down the aisle and sampling a piece of, you know, lasagna noodle, pulling a lasagna noodle out of one of the bins. Things weren't especially sanitary then. But it was a great place. But yeah, when I started working at Middleton, I remember that it was the first month I worked there at the high school. That was when we were asked to be on the Oprah show.
Okay, that was the first month that you were there. Okay,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah, that was the first month.
So why don't we segue into the Oprah show then? Could, you know, talk about that with this.
Yeah, and I remember, what was the name of the principal at Elm Lawn? A lesbian who had been in the community for a really long time.
Harriet. She was Harriet's partner. Harriet, who worked at MG&E.
No, not... She didn't work at MG&E.
Harriet did, but it was the partner who was the principal. Mm-hmm. Tall, dark mm-hmm. hair. I can't mm-hmm. think of her name right now.
And they've moved to the Southwest.
Yes.
And she wasn't out of the closet at that time.
She was a principal at Elm Lawn. I remember calling her up and saying, whatever her name is, what do you think's going to happen if I go on the Oprah show? Because we had gotten this call. Actually, it was because of
Sunshine and Joan were supposed to be on it, and they couldn't do it at the last minute. And so they called us and said, can you go instead of us?
Okay.
Yeah.
And it was about same-sex marriage, so it was definitely going to be an outing situation.
And it was something that we felt pretty strongly about. I think at the time, we weren't planning to be legally married, but we certainly were very interested in things progressing in Madison, and had we already sued the lawsuit against the Y?
Yeah,
which basically spearheaded the domestic partner ordinance in Madison.
So we'll go back to that.
Yeah.
In a minute.
Right? So anyway, I called her up and I said, "Well, what do you think? I don't have a signed contract. I'm on a replacement contract at Middleton High School. I really, really want to keep the job. Do you think this is going to be a problem? Do you think they're going to come after me if I'm out to 4 million people at 3 o'clock in the afternoon?"
More like 400 million people.
Yeah, everyone ran home and watched it in those days. And she just, I just remember she just said, "You are totally on your own. I have no idea." And, you know, she wasn't especially supportive, but she was probably trying to be realistic, which is something that didn't occur to me very frequently. I was thinking, Oprah, let's go. I think we were a little bit worried about what it was going to be like, just the whole glamour of it. And
yeah,
I remember I managed to take a day off for the filming, and then it was going to be shown early December. And I remember I called you at work and said, "Do you want to be on the Oprah show?"
And I said, "I have to call you back. I'm dictating a report." But then I did call back and I said, "Well, let's do it. And you know, if you want to do it, let's do it. Because we're never going to have the chance again, you know, and Oprah's a big deal."
And we wanted to talk to our kids. I mean, Emily was pretty young and she went to Winger School, and nobody could have cared less at Winger School. We had lots and lots of gay and lesbian friends. We had straight friends in town. It didn't seem like it would be a problem.
Yeah, Tim was very supportive. Remember?
And Timothy was a freshman in high school. And he was like, "Well, Mom, that's what I expect you to do. You've always, you know, taught us that this is the right thing to do. Go ahead." So we did, and I think our biggest trauma was, what are we going to wear?
And then having the makeup people, you know, like, mess with your face. I didn't really care for that much, but I guess you shine too much if you're on TV because of the light, so they have to put all this powder and stuff on you.
Yeah, they had to wrestle Alex in the green room. She was like, no makeup!
But we were on with Bob Paris and Rod Jackson, who at that time were legally married, or were married anyhow, former Mr. Universe and his bodybuilding male model partner. They were just charming. We really liked them a lot. And Gloria Allred was on that show with us. Now there were two people whose names I have erased from my memory who were on the other side, who were very conservative media or journalist people who were very homophobic also, and very confrontational. Well, and back in the day, when Oprah had confrontations occurring.
Yeah, that was her style then. And it was when she had just lost all that weight, and she brought in the... it was a representation of all the weight she'd lost, and it was actually like cow blubber or something.
I didn't remember that.
I don't think she did it when we were there, but I remember she was skinny, Mm-hmm. And Alex always remembers her necklace.
Oh,
she was mesmerized.
She had bling like you wouldn't believe. What? And we're sitting this far apart, you know, and I'm just like looking at this diamond or gold or whatever it was. I mean, and she's too, she was gorgeous too. It was hard to take your eyes off.
She was. She was fabulous. Mm-hmm. It's just so funny if you watch the tape because Alex has on, I don't know, corduroy pants and a Lands End sweater.
No, I had on a nice, like,
was it raspberry?
Mandarin Collin long sleeve dressy. Mandarin Collin raspberry button down, you know, down here. Nice dress top, and then some sort of, I don't know what I had on the bottom, but luckily they only show about this much. And, mm-hmm. you know, they put your name on them. They mm-hmm. have this little thing under us. They said, Martha Pop. Lesbian raising children.
No, I think it was just lesbians raising children kept flashing by. And Alex and the tape, she's like this, just sort of shell shocked sitting there.
It was intimidating. Yeah. You know, uh-huh. It's a live audience and you're on national TV, you know.
Right.
It
was hard.
And I remember I wore this ridiculous dress with like a wide belt and it was when wearing white stockings was popular. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, and I remember my sister later saying, you should have just worn jeans. So we were pretty much our butch and femme mm-hmm. style, and that was one of the women in the audience stood up and yelled at us, why don't you just marry a man? Wow. Yeah.
And you got honor, remember?
Yeah.
What'd you say?
How do you think that makes my children feel sitting at home watching you say something like that? She just laid her out, you know.
Good.
Was that where I saw it?
Yeah. How dare you say that to me? I mean, you nailed it.
Good for you.
It was pretty, it was kind of scary.
I'll bet.
Because things were coming at you and they were asking questions and they had these professional people there who... Or who knows if they put them in the audience just to heckle
mm-hmm.
and
tell her what happened at the end with the guy in the car.
Oh yeah, at the end, kid is peeing out there. How adorable! Oh my god!
Oh, that's Yawkey. Oh, good for you, Yawkey.
Oh, that's so cute. At the end. They were going to sweep us off in a limousine to
the Nico Hotel
in Chicago, which was so elegant. And we were going to have lunch or dinner there. And so we came rushing out after the show, and there was the limo sitting there with the door open. And I looked in to the limo, and there was the horrible Bible-beating right-wing, scary journalist in there.
The man, yeah.
The man that was on the panel with us, who had been saying horrible things and quoting Bible passages and just carrying on. And so I looked in and I was like, oh no, not getting in there. And Gloria Allred, I mean, you've seen her. She said, step aside, I'll take care of him. And in she swept into the limo and
slam with the door.
Off it took. From then on, we knew we had to have Gloria on our side. And actually, she was wonderful. Backstage, she took us aside and she says, you need to get a will. You need to mm-hmm. have legal rights. You need to work on rights for your children.
Yeah, she was just no nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, just like, this is what you need to do right now.
Yeah, and we thought we were so political and we'd been doing all these things. But when we met Gloria, we thought, we need to do so much more.
Mm-hmm.
This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Remind listeners who Gloria is.
Well, she is an incredibly famous attorney based in Los Angeles. She was the attorney for the O.J. Simpson for...
Michael Jackson. She represented Michael Jackson.
Before that, when O.J. Simpson allegedly...
Oh, I think she represented Nicole Simpson's estate, didn't she?
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
She's very high profile. She came out of the LA County Prosecutor's Office, but she's been in private practice for years and years, and she's just a bulldog. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And smart as 10 quips.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And just very, you know, this is how it is. Listen to me. You know,
mm-hmm.
just knows her stuff to hold. So
mm-hmm.
she was a good ally that day.
Yeah.
She was. She was great. And then when the show was finally aired,
okay,
I think it was, I want to say December 4th. Mm. I don't know why that date just springs to mind. But it was a school day, of course. Oprah was on weekdays. And I knew it was going to be happening that afternoon. And I thought, well, here goes. Everyone's going to know by the next day. Went to work, did my thing at school. You were at work. And afterwards, I thought, well, just to calm my nerves, I'm going to go out to Yonkers and go Christmas shopping. And they still had Yonkers. So I'm at Yonkers. It's just about the time it's going to air, which I think was going to be 4 o'clock. And I'm on the escalator, and a gay man that we used to know named Dwayne was going down the escalator, and I was going up, and he saw me, and he goes, "Martha, get to the appliance center. They're lesbians on Oprah." And very calmly, I turned around and went, "Oh, that's me."
Oh, how wonderful. Did you go to the appliance center?
Yeah, I think I did. Either that or the men's department to see if Dwayne had passed out. I think he worked there in the men's. Mm-hmm. In men's, yeah.
And was there any fallout?
It was homophobia. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew people had watched it. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of silence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's what you said you most noticed, was that nobody said anything to you about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Alex, would you like a blanket?
No.
To warm you like you're okay. All right.
I felt that there was a lot of homophobia connected with it. At the time, I hadn't met Vicki Schaefer yet. I met her, I think, soon after that, or the next year. So I didn't know anyone else who was a lesbian at Middleton High School.
Hmm.
And, I mean, I really didn't know anybody there.
Mm-hmm.
I had taken the job, but I certainly didn't have any connections there at all. So I felt good about what we had done. And certainly I was a little starstruck because of the experience and being whisked off to Chicago and in a limousine and eating chocolate and champagne and having the waiter put our leftovers into a swan.
He made a swan he was a gay man too, of course. He made a swan out of tinfoil.
Oh.
And brought it. When he brought us dessert, he said, "Chocolate and champagne, complete protein, darling."
We were in heaven, of course.
Oh, how wonderful.
So, back to Middleton. I think I was just thinking, okay, I want to just make sure I get a contract signed, and I don't want anyone to come to me and say, what's going on? We're not going to trust you with high school students or whatever. But at the same time, I really knew in my heart that it was my right, and that I wasn't afraid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that if anybody tried to do that to me, that I would sue.
Right.
I mean, I felt very strongly about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I also thought, Alex has a good job. If something happens, I'm not going to back down.
Mm-hmm.
And
good for you.
It doesn't matter, because what really matters is that there are rights, that the people everywhere are going to have some effect from this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky, I think, because I was older. You know, I was in my 40s, and I was able to say, this is what I want to do. You know, I want to follow through with this. This is important. And so nothing really did happen. However, we were also taped at the same time on a public television show about families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Madison, Wisconsin Public TV.
Yeah, Wisconsin Public Television. And they came to the house and followed us around and did some quick photography work or camera work with the kids getting ready. I think it was something like eggs frying in a skillet and Timothy taking the garbage cans in and walking off to go to West High School. And that was pretty interesting because they wanted to come to Middleton High School and film me working in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of concerned about how that was going to be. And that was when I came out to Doris, who was associate principal. Doris Schrader, who was assistant principal at Middleton. And I'm probably not outing her, but pretty sure she was a sister. And so she came up to me in the hall one day, and she had a clipboard with her, and she was doing her thing around the hall. And she said, I got a call from public television, and they were saying they wanted to come in and do some filming with you. And I was like, oh, really? Mm-hmm. She said, well, what's that all about? And I just looked her right in the eye, and I said, it's about lesbians raising children. And she got so flustered. She was like, okay, well, I see. And, started making some frantic notes, and they came in, and I think they filmed like the outside of the school, and it really wasn't much. I mean, they didn't actually come into the classroom or anything. But the great thing was that Doris became an ally for me. Mm. She really, she had my back.
Oh.
Yeah.
So important.
It was. It was. And I knew it because I think we ended up inviting her to our commitment ceremony. And she didn't come, but I remember when she retired, she gave me the best classroom.
Oh.
And everyone was saying, wait a minute, how did you get the classroom with the windows and the trees
and as a teacher,
the good heating element and a nice wall?
Oh, that's wonderful.
I was like, I don't know, I guess privilege.
Lesbian privilege,
that's great.
So what happened to you after the Oprah show?
Nothing.
Nobody said anything? No one saw it?
I don't think there was any, I wasn't worried about it like a little bit like you were. And people have since asked, can we watch the tape? Of course, people have wanted to see it. And I think I think Donna saw it. Donna and somebody saw it.
Yeah, she has a copy.
Yeah, I told people at work it was going to happen. And then I came back and told them what it was like and, what the experience was like. And yeah, people were pretty ho-hum about it, but I think it made an impression on people. Hey, you're on Oprah? Wow, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I had an experience where one of the other teachers really stood up for me. He was the softball coach, so of course he knew lesbians, according to him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Lisa Wing. He would always talk about Lisa Wing was on his softball team. And I was team teaching in a science class, in a biology class. They had the speech pathologists come in and work with some of the teachers with language issues. And I was standing in front of the class, and one of the young men who had quite a few problems. I actually got to know him pretty well afterwards, but he stood up and said, in front of 30 kids, I hear you're a lesbian.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what did you do?
And I looked at him, and I looked at all the faces staring at me, and I took a breath, and I just said, yes, I am. Now sit down. Perfect. I wanted to say shut up, but I probably just said, no, sit down. And my heart was like, boom, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And so I was teaching with a science teacher who was one of these people who like whip up and down in front of the class. I don't even know if he heard it or not. But the next class I went into was Rashab, who was this special ed teacher and softball coach. And he heard about it. And he got up in front of the kids that were in there, and he just like laid them out. He was like, I don't ever want to hear anything against Miss Pop. She's a great teacher. She's a wonderful person. Mm-hmm. He just really, really gave me so much support. And that really felt good that he was there for me.
It really shows the importance of being an ally, doesn't it?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one thing that Martha's leaving out from her teaching career is that how much of a guiding light she was for so many misguided kids. Mm. How much of an advocate for them she was, how she went to bat for them time and time again when they were confronted with racial injustice or class injustice or things that they just couldn't figure out on their own. How she took them under their wing, went girls who were pregnant or had babies, you know, boys who were just messing up big time, went to court for them. I mean, she really laid herself out for them and the parents in a lot of cases too. Hmm. You know, and I really believe that she changed a lot of young lives for the better, not just in the academic and not just in the speech pathology behavioral issues in the classroom, but really made an impact on their lives that I think a lot of them will always remember. You know, she created awards for kids who did special things throughout the years and had ceremonies and, you know, for these awards to be presented to them in front of their peers, and really stood up and stood by them and when they needed someone to be there for them in a way that a lot of teachers don't have the time or really the skill or the caring to do. Mm-hmm. You know? And mm-hmm. She went way, way, way beyond what you do in a classroom. And I really think a lot of kids owe her a huge debt of gratitude for that. And I think they realize how important that she was important to them in their lives.
Yeah.
And then I began to burn out.
Certainly.
Right.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Certainly. It happens.
Oh, yeah.
What about starting the Gay Straight Alliance? Were you instrumental in starting it at Middleton? Did you come?
I was on a committee that explored the idea of starting a Gay Straight Alliance, and it came from our, oh gosh, what were all those acronyms? I know what they were. They were called, they were teams. When you have like early release and you get together with your colleagues and you come up with ideas. And then we also had, we were working with the drug and alcohol AODA. Mm-hmm. And so we thought we could do this under the umbrella of several existing things that are happening at the high school, and have a safe place for kids who are identifying as gay or lesbian or bisexual, and also a place where they can come and talk and have adults who are there for them and do activities, provide activities in the school, like starting when Matthew Shepard was killed, and doing other types of Day of Respect and
Day of Silence,
Day of Silence, and So we thought, well, we'll see if we can get this going within the school, within the systems that already are created. And I think Vicki and I had met by then at...
Vicki Schaefer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Vicki and I had met...
Didn't you do a training with her at the WEAC conference in October? Is that...
We actually met at a breakout group at Franklin School.
At the WEAC, during the WEAC
That
conference.
Was WEAC, yeah. And it was... you probably remember that they used to have... a support group for teachers.
Mm-hmm. I do remember.
It was probably GLEE or GLADE, but would sponsor through WEAC, through the Teachers Convention, mm-hmm. a time for all teachers to come together and mm-hmm. share stories. And I still remember meeting Vicki that day because it was a big circle and she was over on one side and I was, and she said she taught in Middleton, and I was like, oh my God, this is wonderful! A person who's a lesbian! Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. she was a femme! I mean, it was like a great day for both of us.
Yeah.
I remember how excited you were when you came home and told me you'd met this wonderful woman. I was just like, oh, thank God, someone that you can, you know, do things with.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had a big age difference. I think she was about as old as my son, you know, differences we were, but it didn't matter, and we were totally excited about meeting each other and having ideas what could happen at Middleton and what we were willing to do. So then it was Lisa Arley and Vicki Schaefer and myself. I remember we called ourselves the Lesbian Avengers. And I think we decided to form this group, but it was also straight teachers too.
Mm-hmm.
And teachers who had gays and lesbians in their families also were involved with it.
It was called the Gay Straight Alliance to End Homophobia. That was the actual name of it. So it was definitely Gay Straight Alliance, but then to end homophobia.
Does it still exist today at Middleton?
Yeah, they still have a group. We were trying to remember who's the advisor now, because Vicki isn't doing it much anymore. She's got her hands full with MASH and a lot of the things she's doing. But yeah, was that 15 years ago?
At least.
Yeah.
Well, it was
even more than that,
because this year is GLSEN's 15th anniversary, which she also helped to start that here, which is now called GSA for Safe Schools.
Mm-hmm. So you helped start GLSEN.
Okay. Yeah.
GLSEN South Central Wisconsin was what the name of it was then. Yeah, it was still a chapter of the national organization until it split off about 5 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago. But I think the alliance at Middleton started before GLSEN.
We did.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember there were a couple of key students who had come to us. One came to us and said... remember that one kid who came down the hall and wanted to talk to me? And he said, I'm gay!
Oh, he was so happy.
He was so excited. He was the one that was going to go to American University.
I don't remember his name now, but remember
he came up to you. I went out in the hall to see him, and he goes, I'm gay! Now I've got to go tell Miss Schaefer and Miss Arley and... Pat Keeler, I remember Mr. Keeler, you know, all the people who were known as being safe people, and we had the things on our doors and
safe zones, yeah.
Safe zone, and we went through a lot of hell with one of our principals, and we had some interesting superintendents. We had the first leadership scholarship at First Unitarian Society with just like 15, 20 people. And now it's huge.
You're talking about GLSEN now.
Yeah, GLSEN. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
The first celebration of leadership was literally about a dozen people in the basement of the youth
first Unitarian. I believe I was there. Judy Gump received an award. I mean, it was...
It was a long time
ago. It was a long time
right.
ago.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they did the premiere of... what was that movie? What was that...
Not Desert Hearts.
No. The one about the educators, the California, two
yeah,
California
it's
women.
Elementary.
It's elementary.
It's elementary.
Yes. They did the national premiere of that at the Barrymore.
And out of the past. Well, that wasn't, that we didn't do that.
That
I mean, everybody
was
did that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That was, and the elementary school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of
people
kids came.
There.
Teachers brought their classes yeah. and stuff. And showed up in limousines. Yeah, it was cool.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
So, and there was another young man at the school who really made me want to stand up and face any opposition, and that was Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Adam, who was, I think he, transgender kid,
mm-hmm.
took a lot of abuse at school, and he was always... He knew that I was a lesbian, but he was very, very, you know, taught, just doing a lot of homophobic stuff.
Mm.
I knew that he was headed for trouble. And
so he was yeah. acting in a homophobic way?
Yes. Yeah, he was testing me a lot.
Yeah, and I don't know what yeah. his sexual orientation was, but he definitely had gender
mm-hmm.
identity.
Uh-huh.
A lot of gender identity concerns.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And he ended up actually trying to kill himself. Yeah. And remember it was Max
mm-hmm.
who saved him. Who was wasn't he a Wingra kid,
mm-hmm.
actually?
Mm-hmm.
And was sensitive enough to know that this was a definite cry for help.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
That was in the early years, Middleton, too.
Hmm. So how are you both doing at this point? Do you need a break? Or, tell, you know, we can stop whenever you need to, and we can continue another day. It's 10 till 4. We could
Go for a while yet. I mean, but do you want to take a little break first, or? I don't particularly want to go home right now.
Well, why don't I stop it for a second here?